Hello and welcome back to another EG session that would have taken place at MIPIM. So near yet so far. I'm Damien Wild and this is our third session of the day and of eight of the week. And thank you to the many hundreds of you who tuned in this morning. I'm sure that our next session will be every bit as good as those. So we had expected a budget for infrastructure tomorrow, but it sounds like we'll have to wait for a bit. A new national infrastructure strategy should appear in May, however. That detailed 30-year plan was to be published alongside the budget and is seen as crucial to the government's plan to level up regional disparities. Other shorter-term issues have got in the way, of course. But that delay could be a good thing. It could see the Chancellor incorporate sustainability into the strategy and sign off on a £100 billion investment over this Parliament in transport, in local growth and in digital infrastructure too. Do that and it will have been worth waiting for and signal that the government is intent on building a Britain fit for the future. To discuss all this and more, we have an outstanding panel in the studio and on the line as well. And I'm pleased to say that it's still no warmer in Cannes than it is here in London. Long may that continue. With me is Pete Gladwell, Head of Public Sector Partnerships at Legal & General Investment Management, John Gravett, Head of Real Estate Investment Management at Cluttons, James Thornton, CEO of Mayfair Capital, and on the line, Louise Ellison, Head of Sustainability at Hammerson. And Pete, I'll start with you. In the early days of this government, the early months of this government, I should say, do you think there is evidence that it gets the link between infrastructure, growth and prosperity?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, Boris is renowned, isn't he, for being a big infrastructure fan, going back to his days as Mayor of London. And I don't think we see any change in the tone really coming out of the government. So for me, the question is, you know, how do they implement that? They recognise the link. How do they then make it happen? And how do they build a kind of coalition of the willing to help them make it happen? This isn't something that the government's going to do on its own balance sheet alone. It's not even something that combined authority mayors can do on their own. It's not even something that local authorities can do on their own. It has to be a coalition of those of us who steward the capital in the nation and the public sector coming together to help make this a reality. So I think the vision's there, the implementation is the next big challenge.
And is there enough of a coalition of the willing?
I think that's coming together, isn't it? But it's how fast it comes together is a question. And then there's some fundamental shifts. You know, if we're looking at what needs to change, there are some, it's fundamental shifts that are going to have to occur. The Green Book has been flagged. That needs to be addressed again. And then I think actually there's some structural shifts in terms of how we as a nation fund our infrastructure. And, you know, whether that's new Northern rail lines or the NHS, certainly domestic investors like LNG want to step up, want to have more of a role, want to fulfill our social role in terms of investing in more of this. But at the moment, there's a need to kind of co-create the structures through which it's funded and then actually implemented. So, the coalition is coming together, but I'm not underestimating the scale of the challenge because some of these things are actually quite structural and are going to take some time to properly address, I think.
Okay, thank you. We'll come back to priorities in a moment, but I'd just like to just test the view of the panel about whether this government does get the link and whether we're right to be optimistic. John?
I think they do understand it. The usual complexities is a bit like you were saying there, is the complexity about which to go about it. So they get it, but using Boris's famous words, unleashing Britain's potential, to do that is going to be quite complicated. And they really need to, you know, we talk about the coalition is just there, which is great, but they've got to take the ownership and leadership, I think, in that. So trying to find some more of the benefits by which they can push out on business rates mitigation in the short term to enable more CapEx, etc. All those sort of initiatives they probably need to lead on first to help that the collaboration amongst the industry wider afield.
So it will build over time, you think? We should expect for all the answers by the summer.
I wish there would be the answers by the summer, but there won't be. But I do hope they show the leadership and direction and stewardship they need to give to make sure the industry comes together to deliver it.
Okay, thank you. And James, are you optimistic?
Yes, I am. I think the political will to spend is very strong. I think the borrowing votes from people in the north has been a very telling quote, and you know the approval of HS2 and all the other things that are coming through. I think they will happen.
It's amazing how quickly the political ground has shifted on that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is, and it's very much favouring the Midlands and the north. I mean, I think you could make the case for Crossrail 2 very easily, but politically, probably not, because it would be seen as favouring the south of England. The problem is that the infrastructure spend, and let's face it, I mean, the 10-year gilt today is sitting at 0.3. okay, that's coronavirus inspired. It's a very good time to be borrowing to spend, and that should come through in economic growth, but it won't come through quickly, and that'll be Boris's dilemma politically. Will it come through in his parliament or the next one?
Okay, we'll come back to speed and perhaps impact of delivery. Louise, how about your view? Do you see that clarity in the government's mind that investing in infrastructure is the right thing to do, and do you see a willingness to invest in the right sort of infrastructure?
I think that there's a willingness to invest. I think there's a keenness to spend. I think that a couple of things that have been mentioned are critical. One is time, because these kinds of investments are going to take time, and I'm not sure that the current leadership is particularly patient. And complexity. I think there's potentially a lack of reality about actually how complex these things are to pull together and to bring together to actually make them happen in a way that really delivers long-term benefit rather than short-term headlines. That would be my caution in the middle of all this optimism.
Okay, and on complexity, how do we deal with that? How do we help them work their way through that? Louise, sorry.
Oh, sorry, you're coming. You want me to solve the problem as well as talk about the question?
Pose the question and solve the problem.
I think the dealing with the complexity, you need to be talking to the market and all of the other guys that you've got in the room there about how and who needs to be in the room and what structures need to be put in place to kind of bring the finance forward and bring the different parties forward. One of the things that I think has also been alluded to is the fact that you need this to be very much regional. You need to, it can't just be based around one area. These things need to really link the connectivity across different areas in order to actually kind of create something that's going to be beneficial in the long term. And to do that, you require all sorts of different parties coming to the table. And you will require kind of long-term funding and lots of very different kind of structures to put that together. But yeah, I mean, the other guys around the table will have much more expertise on that than me.
Don't worry, I'm going to put that to them as well. And in the spirit of posing the question and demanding the solution, I'll do that for you as well, Pete. You said that there needed to be a structural shift in funding, which is a tacit acknowledgement that this is quite complex.
Yeah.
How is that solved?
For me, I actually see in some ways what we're trying to do here is rip out the complexity that we put in pre-credit crunch. We're looking to move away from the heavily securitized structures that we as a country came to rely on, things like, very complex PFIs, et cetera, to move to a more organic model where those of us who steward the nation's capital, and I don't mean just LNG, you know, there are many other sources of capital are available, actually organically invest into the social need for investment locally. And that's often, I think Louise is absolutely right, represented by someone like a combined authority mayor or a local authority. So for me, it's trying to strip away the hugely complex traded credit models that were, and the securitization models that were the investment banks were big proponents of in pre-credit crunch, to say, look, how do we work as a team? We, let's say East Birmingham needs a new tram. How do we collaborate to make that happen, to get the right funding structure, and how do we make it as organic and simple as possible? Actually, where I think there's probably a bit of complexity we need to address is around the different government departments that are involved in that, and particularly Treasury, and helping them to become part of the solution rather than a gatekeeper. So if it was me, I would actually be putting someone from the Treasury in Andy Street's team and saying, look, we're not going to be coming and giving you proposals anymore. You're going to co-create the proposals with us, and it's your job to go back to your colleagues and make sure they tick the boxes around state aid and balance sheet treatment, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the kind of structure changes I'm talking about that I think need to change. And actually, it's trying to cut through some of the complexity within government to get a more organic model that says what's the need for investment locally, and then how do we deliver on it quickly and hopefully cut through some of the many layers of bureaucracy that can otherwise get in the way.
So if it is a case of...
Right, I think that's a really interesting point, actually, because getting the right people to be doing the right, getting the specialist knowledge to be solving the different, coming up with different answers and solving the different problems, and getting a real kind of collaboration between different departments and different people, I think is going to be critical to it.
Okay, thank you. And Pete, if it is a case of Back to the Future, is the reason why it hasn't happened before the simplification of the private sector model because the politics wasn't aligned? Has devolution enabled this?
So I think devolution is definitely a benefit, and the general perception and the recognition that Whitehall needs to let people go and actually give them some more local agency to actually have an impact. You know, if we, without washing all of the financial sector's dirty laundry, I think there's also a sense that, you know, those of us who steward the nation's capital have too often sat in ivory towers not far from here, waited for investment banks to bring us bits of paper to fund these things without getting out there and meeting Andy Street or James Palmer directly and saying, look, what's your need locally and how do we co-create the structure with you? So we've, you know, if you wind the clock back 5 years, it was too easy to just sit in an office a mile away from here and wait for investment banks to give you deals and decide whether you like the look of them or not and never dirty your feet by going as far as Bolton or somewhere like that where both my parents grew up. So actually I think it's partly been a reaction, a recognition from those of us in the financial sector that if you're stewarding that much money from around, you know, Bolton and Bristol, we need to be getting out there and seeing what the need for investment is locally.
Okay, your shoes look reassuringly dirty under the table. John?
I'll just follow up on that and say, as well as that, the solution's got to be about the education piece. And the whole supply chain, you know, it comes after the capital, then everyone makes the great ideas, what we're going to do, how we're going to spend it, but then how are you actually going to enable that and actually use that capital wisely and do it at pace? And often it's a little bit of an afterthought, money comes in, start project, and actually you've forgotten actually how you're going to build, construct, acquisition, planning, design, implementation, then management thereafter. And these things come in after the wigs around the city have gone, yes, here's the cash. So part of the solution is making sure we bring the whole life cycle and that supply chain, you know, and those leaders in that to the forefront now at this early stage and form part of this process with government as well.
And there's a willingness there, is there?
I think there absolutely is. It's just how we enable that, because there's things that people have spoken about historically but being quite poor actually delivering on. So that would be, I think, quite a cultural change to actually include that throughout the process.
Okay, thank you. And James, I'm asking everyone to solve the problem that they posed. And you posed the issue of speed of delivery, and will the political currency and the political benefits follow on infrastructure when it takes so long to be delivered? Does that mean that the government is more likely to invest in the wrong projects because they deliver short-term returns?
Not necessarily. I'm not close enough to government and the public sector as my three fellow contributors are today, to be honest. But I just see a real political will. Boris, I think, wants to make a difference. And, you know, a lot of money was spent on HS2 before it was approved. And, you know, that wasn't this Conservative government, but I think the need is seen.
Okay. And Louise, you raised that issue of it requiring patience as well. Do you think that's a risk? The wrong project might get backed because it will deliver returns in less than 5 years?
I think that's always a risk. I mean, it's just part of the political risk that you get with any of these kinds of decision making. It's very difficult, I think, for politicians, and particularly in the current environment, to be making decisions to invest huge amounts of money that aren't going to give them a return within a political cycle. The tendency will always be not to do that. So it adds a different dimension into the decision making, which isn't necessarily ideal. So trying to kind of steer away from that and really make very transparent the real long-term benefits that come from the right decisions being made, and things in kind of different locations. I think potentially the narrative that's very alive at the moment, and as everybody has alluded to, about this levelling up and about channeling funds and investment into the regions, may be very helpful from that point of view, because it's going to be difficult to ignore them. So that may sort of bring a different perspective into the decision making the decisions that are being made. But I do think it's still a very significant risk that you're going to get investment in things that are inevitably going to be more attractive if they're going to give you a shorter term win and going to be sort of and give you some political return more quickly. You know, it's like any kind of decision making on investment, and it's not just politics that has those weaknesses.
Okay, John.
Yeah, on that note, I mean, one we've seen there is the change to gigabit policy rather than full fibre. You know, probably a great move in the short term. It's going to increase our capacity across, you know, for the housing, levelling up businesses across the UK. But in the long run, when we look back in 30 years' time, go, we really should have gone just for full fibre because that was future-proofing the industry. So, you know, absolutely putting up
Louise's points.
There are live examples there. Policy making, change of shift there. Probably great move in the next 5-10 years, but will we look back in 30 years ago, wrong call. But that's a live example I can think of.
Okay, thank you. And Pete, something that Louise raised there that I wonder how significant it is. It's about capturing the zeitgeist and for the property industry as well as government. If government is talking about levelling up, if it is prioritising sustainability and looking at other areas too, it's important that this industry starts to speak that language. Do you think it's ready to do so?
I mean, I'm not here to sell LNG, and there are many things LNG could do better, but being frank, we've been doing it for a very long time. You know, we've got partnerships in places like Salford, Newcastle, Cardiff, Sunderland, Bristol, that go stretch way back beyond the kind of levelling up agenda becoming fashionable. And for me, it's not really about pandering to the current generation of politicians. It's about doing the right thing. You know, in Bristol, for example, LNG has 115,000 customers. So we have to be investing back into Bristol because it's their money and they gave it to us in the first place to steward. So they are looking for a financial outcome, which is that we're providing them with a pension. They're also looking for a social outcome, which is their money being reinvested back into their place. It's become fashionable all of a sudden. That's fantastic. And I'm sure more people will be doing it. But if someone came to me, I'd say do it because it's the right thing to do, not do it because Boris has suddenly started talking about it.
Yeah, my point wasn't quite so cynical, actually. One person's pandering is another person's pragmatism, I suppose. But there's an importance there. If you need the ear of Treasury or need the ear of a particular local authority, you have to learn to speak that language.
Yeah, you do. And but again, for me, it comes back to if you think your role is to invest into the regions, then, you know, you have to be engaging with local authorities because otherwise you won't know what the need for investment is. It's, you know, it would be a totally missed point to just jump on a train, go to Aberdeen and start, you know, building something that was totally at odds to what the local authority wanted. So for us, the need to engage with the local authority in particular and combined authorities, particularly taking an increasing importance regionally, is just about, it's de-risks it from a commercial perspective as well. You're going to be investing in things that people need for the longer term. That's by its very nature a lower risk investment. And so you're more likely to generate the returns you need over 10, 20, 30, 40 years. You know, just to Louise's point, it's a very different mindset from someone who needs to be re-elected in 4 or 5 years. We need to make sure that if we're investing in affordable housing, it's still generating income in 30 or 40 years because we will still be paying pensions in 30 or 40 years. So there's a natural alignment between some of these things that creates a virtuous circle.
Okay, and James, you're less close to government, local and national, but is this a consideration for you in terms of how you reflect the political mood of the time?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's not just government.
How does that manifest itself?
It's investors, actually. I mean, ESG, measuring the impact of your investment, is absolutely top of the criteria. You know, if we're asked to pitch for a new mandate, it's pretty much one of the first questions the consultants will ask. And, you know, impact investment doesn't mean giving up some of your return. It means looking at the impact that your investment has made on the local community and all those other things. And this is, you know, it's very important.
And how recently has that change manifested itself?
I think the last 12 months, it's gone pretty much to the top of the list, actually.
Okay, and Louise, in terms of, we'll come back to ESG perhaps in a moment, but in terms of reflecting a new government and its changed set of priorities and trying to capitalise on the benefits that infrastructure investment means, does that change the way you act, think or speak?
I don't think it really changes, though. It doesn't change what we do. And obviously Hammerson's a business with, you know, investments all over the country. And so for us, seeing those kinds of or seeing a mindset that wants to invest in the regions, or that it, that is more minded to invest in the regions, is very beneficial and really helpful. It's what's been required for some time, one could argue. So it wouldn't create a change in the way we're thinking, but it certainly, and I think it's probably because that's the way the whole of the economy is moving, is kind of in line with the sort of plans that businesses like Hammerson are making at the moment.
And that is a response to a local demand that's, you know, perhaps Whitehall has caught up with, you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I think your point about devolution and changes in local government and the requirements from local government, that real kind of underfunding of local government, I suppose, that's happened, the cutting back that's happened in local government over the last few years. I mean, businesses like ours with those regional kinds of investments, we've really seen it. You know, there's tens of thousands of people employed across the assets that we own. So, you know, by the retailers and things that are operating there, they're very real elements of local infrastructure in their own right. So we see very much at first hand what's going on, whether that's in sort of increased homelessness and all the sort of social ills that we see across the city centres that we are trying to kind of trying to support local organisations in trying to deal with and trying to make a difference to, right the way through to all of the people who are kind of just employed in the centres that we have. These are really important things that are happening. So we're very, very connected with all of those local issues, and we're very pleased at, you know, to see that there is more of an agenda for investing in some of those regions, and long may it continue. But as I say, I think you need to have something that's quite coordinated. You need to have local authorities that are talking to each other, and as Pete said earlier, talking to Treasury and having a really constructive, positive relationship about how these things can be funded into the longer term. And that point about, you know, the wanting to level up the regions, it's not about businesses suddenly wanting to do something off the back of that, but it's much more about it being more difficult for the politics to ignore the regions at the moment than it potentially has been in the past.
Okay, thank you. And John, there's always a danger with these sorts of, I nearly said events, podcasts. We're here in the studio rather than in Cannes. But there's always a danger that you have a coalition of the willing in the room or on the line and, you know, putting impact investing front and centre of what they do. But is it as widespread as it needs to be, domestically or internationally?
I think we are, that the leveraging needs to happen more. I think we've always been focusing on those main arteries throughout the UK. Yes, that's been happening, but we're talking going far wider to the much smaller communities. So I'm doing an awful lot with the towns and small cities with, you know, City Fibre and the other operators rolling out 5G and fixed line. And, you know, it is new for those industries, and those local authorities are really engaging, which is great. But the private sector needs to really put in those task force to actually work and operate with the local authorities, and the central government need to continue that cooperation as well. So we are meeting a lot with central government, but, you know, actions need to be taken out and actually implemented. And we know government themselves are doing a lot of change within their property unit, and they can be great supporters in that through things like the GPA, etc., trying to focus and deliver and help support this sector as well, and what needs to happen from an infrastructure perspective.
Okay, thank you. Let's get into sustainability a little bit more specifically. And Louise, I'll start with you. I asked at the beginning about whether that understanding that is there within government, the link between infrastructure investment, growth and prosperity nationally. Do you think equally it's as well understood that sustainability needs to underpin all of those decisions?
I think it's patchy. Sometimes, in some areas it is, but I think in other areas it isn't. And I think the kind of long-term nature of some of the challenges we face with climate change and sustainability mean that you've got issues that are perhaps more difficult to address now. And I think there are the obvious things around kind of infrastructure and travel and connectivity that I think, and just things like power, the case for that relationship between resolving issues around climate change and sustainability through investment in infrastructure, and the two combined giving you much better long-term returns if you are dealing with sustainability and you are having a positive impact, as James talked about, are fairly straightforward. There are other areas that I think are less obvious. And if you start thinking about, you know, some of the digital infrastructure and the connections between digital infrastructure, and as it was being talked about earlier, that kind of decision not to invest in fibre and to go in a slightly different direction with that, and whether or not the long-term impacts of that, just in terms of, you know, of carbon emissions and how we communicate with each other across different regions, is going to is less obvious, but I think it's really quite critical. And then the upskilling side of it, there's a huge potential for investment in skills for skills and training for all sorts of different sectors, whether that be, as I say, power, whether that be engineering, all of these kind of different areas, which will potentially provide huge benefit, real long-term kind of benefits for the country as a whole. We should be able to be kind of exporting all sorts of expertise around sustainability, power, climate change, engineering, and really investing in that. I don't think it's necessarily fully understood what the benefits of that could be.
But there is the opportunity there, by the sound of it, for the UK to cast itself as a global leader.
I would say so. I mean, you know, we've come a huge way. We've really supported, through supporting the energy grid, we've really supported quite a lot of engineering over the last kind of 10 to 15 years. We've been very effective in doing some of this stuff, and I think we could really export that expertise. We really could become and be seen as kind of global leaders in this area. If I have conversations with investors, and I have, you know, as James said, increasingly frequent conversations with investors about ESG and sustainability, and it's always the view is that Europe does this better than many other regions, and the UK does this better. It's kind of pretty much one of the leader in terms of delivering sustainability, particularly across the real estate. I'm kind of slightly one trick pony in terms of real estate, but particularly in terms of our sector, we do it a lot better than many other jurisdictions. So that is a real kind of benefit that we have as both as a sector, but also as an economy. And I think it's something that we need to invest more in.
And James, do you get that positive reaction that it's merely trying to prove your credentials rather than trying to make the case that that the UK does lead on this?
Yes, we're not asked the question whether we're leading the UK, but the measurability, how we are investing, is very much under scrutiny from a sustainability viewpoint.
And so yeah. of all the ESG considerations that might apply, is it sustainability that is number one in the minds of those who are appointing you?
It probably is, but the others are very important as well, actually.
Okay, yeah. And yeah. Pete, just thinking about the question I started off with Louise about whether the government really sees sustainability as being a priority when it's looking at infrastructure investment. There is some early evidence of that. If I think about a recent announcement for the east of England, where the rail line was prioritised over the road, or minded to prioritise, perhaps that could yet change. Do you see lots of evidence of that, or is that an isolated example?
I think we see a lot of evidence. And I mean, the Government Property Agency, who've been alluded to earlier, have already been taking quite a strong stance, and you'll know we do a lot of funding for them, and they're already starting to lift the criteria of what they're looking for as an occupier. The Cabinet Office are also working very hard on this at the moment. It's very much off the time, but I think that's a really exciting challenge for us as an industry. You know, it's a chance for us to demonstrate our skills. You know, it's already been mentioned, a lot of the public sector at the moment and local authorities have been quite stripped back, so they don't have the resource to really take a lead in this. The intention is absolutely there, and I'm taking nothing away from the intention or the skill. It's literally a question of resource. So being able to invest in people, in some of the key startups that are likely to drive this revolution in the UK, and then us as an industry providing those with sufficient capital and opportunity to really have a proper impact around the country, not just in London, but in around the country, you know, properly, is a really exciting challenge for, I think, for us as an industry, because we have all the skills really within what we're doing already. We already have people who specialise in sustainability. You know, we are aware of lots of people who can have electric charging, solar, ground source heat pumps, etc., etc. So these tools are at our hand. They are a big investment opportunity, and they're also a chance to have a major impact going forward. And I do think the government really wants us to be leaders in this space, and that sets an exciting tone where if you as someone, as a corporate, is coming to them saying we want to take a lead in this, that stance would be welcomed.
Picking up on that, what's interesting though is bringing those silos which have been working independently in the past together. So, you know, you're looking at, you know, the future, you know, electric vehicles will be is actually paramount for 2030, you know, changing from diesel, petrol, going to electric fully. EV charging points, 210,000 charging points they're saying is required. They're talking about the old, the new Condalus inductive charging up along the roads, how you then overlay that with digital connectivity because they have autonomous vehicles. So you're bringing quite a few sectors together in this, which is one of the first times you're bringing these massive industries to work in one on one scheme. So it's massively exciting, and there's great opportunity for UK PLC, but there's an awful lot to get under the skin of in the next 4, 5, 6 years of how we can actually deliver these projects on the ground, which then could be taken overseas internationally.
And we can move away from saying, well, where's the money coming from? Because the money is there. There are huge amounts of capital ready to invest in this. And actually, you can see the revenue streams as well. People will pay to have their cars charged. People will see the benefits in terms of fuel savings, moving to solar panels. So that's, for me, why it makes such sense, because it's not one of these things where there's a huge bill and there's no sign of any revenue. The economics work, and it's the right thing to do, and really exciting challenge. It's a matter of joining up the dots and setting some leadership to make it happen.
So if the money's there and the fiscal rules are waiting to be rewritten, the skills are broadly there. I think you've all successfully addressed the complexity and the time frame earlier. What is going to hold us back? What is the risk here? James, do you see risks that might halt this progress?
I think it's government's ability to deploy, actually. I mean, I think investing in infrastructure and public transport is what needs to happen, and these projects are on a national scale. You know, you can't hand over HS2 to a third party. The government has to organise that. And
it was supposedly considered, wasn't it, but rejected?
Yes, indeed, indeed. You know, Heath, what are we going to do about the airport capacity? You know, that's still absolutely undecided. Yes, the environmental lobby is now heavily involved in that, but we need more sustainable air travel, and we need more capacity, and we've got to solve those two things at the same time.
So Louise, James raises a tension there, doesn't he, that was shown in the recent Heathrow decision, that they're investing in infrastructure is fine at a headline level, but it may stand in, that sustainability considerations may stop us investing in some of that infrastructure, no matter how necessary it seems.
Yeah, and I think we have to be realistic. I mean, one of the I suppose there are a couple of things that I think there are risks to this, and one of them we've talked about a bit, which is a political risk that's part of it. The other, there's an element also of kind of behavioural change that's required, which kind of goes into this issue around our airline capacity and airport capacity and things. So you're always going to end up with these decisions that are hard decisions about where is the best place to deploy your capital. And if we are seriously going to tackle the level of climate change that we've got, then you can't do that and at the same time say, but it's okay for us to keep flying to the same extent that we do, or expand the amount of flying, or, you know, use a portion of the UK as a hub airport. The two things just simply they don't align at all. So I think that we have to have some realism about that, and then look for alternatives to it. And when we were, you know, talking about digital infrastructure and things earlier, and John was talking about decisions around fibre, that's where we need to be kind of focusing quite a lot of attention in terms of how we change the way we communicate. And it's fascinating, isn't it? Because we're sat here today in London because none of us have actually gone down to Miffin, because Miffin has been cancelled, and how many of us have just got different arrangements in place to carry on doing business. And I know you can't do that with everything, and it's, you know, the service sector, it can kind of respond in these kinds of ways much more easily potentially than other sectors. But it is a really important part of what the way we need to change our thinking. And I think there will be decisions that we make that mean that we have to kind of change some of the things that we do. And it's not like we're never going to be able to fly. It's not like we're never going to be able to eat meat. But there is going to have to be some changes. And I think those decisions are going to be quite hard, but they're going to have to be made.
And John, how, to what extent can digital infrastructure replace physical infrastructure?
Well, it would. We need both, absolutely. But I think digital will enable people to actually access things quicker, enable different ways of working, driving that different behaviour. The biggest thing is psychologically, we as people have got to change and actually adapt to dialing in. I mean, we're seeing that as we speak at the moment with the current, you know, crisis that we're facing from the health coronavirus, whereby we, you know, people are starting to think about business continuity in a serious way. Everyone's going to work from home. You know, in a way, are we going to find out the broadband strength across the UK in the next 8 to 12 weeks? We probably are going to find out how resilient it is and how good or bad copper is. So I think through these, you're going to find out the digital infrastructure is absolutely required by the way we need to change the way we do things and operate, and the way I think society is changing and the younger generations are driving that change. So I think when we get the new wave of people entering the industry in the next 10, 15 years, that will support the change of mindset that we're currently going through.
Okay, thank you. We're up against the clock as ever. And Pete, I was wondering, listening to all of this wisdom around the table today, it strikes me that this could be the saving of real estate, couldn't it? Which hasn't always enjoyed the best of reputations, but there are real parallels between the government's agenda, the diagnosis of the national problem, if you like, and the areas in which real estate is skilled. Do you see that alignment?
Absolutely. I think it's about rediscovering what we exist for as an industry. And so much of this is actually saying, well, what's the local need for real estate? What are the local ambitions of a place? What are its need? Is it affordable housing? Is it a new hospital? Is it a new tram? Is it a new factory to create something that, you know, is a local skill? And actually, then we as an industry can provide what's required in that local situation. It's really exciting. I think as we rediscover that, and as local areas are given more agency to actually control their own destiny, then we've got a really exciting opportunity to respond and do so in a very environmentally friendly way that again sets new standards there. Because whatever we do in, you know, the West Midlands, for example, they are going to demand a new standard in terms of sustainability. So I genuinely think it's a very exciting time for us at the moment.
Okay, and lastly and quickly, whether it's the Chancellor tomorrow at the dispatch box delivering the budget, or whether it's the expected infrastructure statement in May, what would you like to see the government prioritise here? Louise, can I start with you, please?
I think probably connectivity, all forms of connectivity. So regional kind of connectivity, power connectivity, digital connectivity.
Okay, thank you. James?
You know, if you look at, there are certain locations in the UK which are already in the regions, the impact of digitalisation, you know, look at Bristol, where the medical centre in Leeds, tech centre in Bristol, the media centre in Manchester, they're all there because they've got the physical infrastructure to be there and to feed off one another. And as investors, that's what we're interested in, because it's creating demand. And if we can provide the buildings that they will take, we will get rental growth and deliver the returns that our investors are looking for.
Thank you. John, what's your priority?
I probably see three areas. One is the electronic communication code. We need clarification on that, because it's been a blocker, more than enabler, over the last 2 years. Legislation for new builds. We're still not building new flats and houses and developments with broadband. So that just needs to be legislated and developed and gone on with. And lastly, business rates relief on full fibre rollout. It's got a 5-year sort of lifespan until 2022, and then goes back to being rated. I think we need to expand that for another 10 years to give that time for the rollout investment.
Okay, thank you. So digital and physical. Pete?
Well, I mean, the topic of this session was infrastructure building a Britain fit for the future. And for me, actually, the ask of Treasury is not a kind of, we'd like these treats, we'd like these presents. It's moving forward to a new way of working that, as I say, is about co-creating the structures that we need to enable Britain to be built for the future together. We need to move away from this idea that we go to Treasury and ask them for a few special tax breaks or a few, you know, a present here or a grant there. Actually, people like LNG, you know, we alone have £1.2 trillion under management. It's about co-creating that future and the structures that we need to invest in digital broadband, but also you know, the new sustainability initiatives we're talking about, trams in West Midlands, et cetera, et cetera. Those models need to be co-created rather than thought up in a room in the Treasury and then presented in the hope that we all like them.
Presumably you'll get a call before May. Well, let me know if you do. I'm afraid we're out of time there. Thank you to our panel. Thank you all for listening in. We're back tomorrow on devolution. Again, if devolution leads, will investment follow? Round about 9:45 from the EG studio here in London. Thank you all very much.